Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Multiple Myeloma Update from the 2013 American Society of Clinical Oncology ASCO Annual Meeting being held here in Chicago. My name is Ann Quinn Young, Vice President of Marketing for the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation. This is a CME activity jointly sponsored by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine, CancerEducation.com, and the MMRF. I'd like to thank our commercial supporters, Celgene Corporation and Onyx Pharmaceuticals, for their support of this activity. Founded in 1998, the MMRF is the number one private funder of myeloma research and is focused on accelerating new treatments to extend and improve the lives of patients and ultimately finding a cure. Over the last 15 years, the MMRF has funded more than 300 grants to more than 120 institutions and companies worldwide focused on leading-edge research to understand the biology of myeloma and identify new targets and promising therapies. Together with our affiliate organization, the Multiple Myeloma Research Consortium, MMRC, we've supported the development of more than 70 different therapeutic approaches, and through the work of the MMRC specifically, we've opened 45 trials of more than 20 different novel agents. Beyond research, we're also the leader in educational programming for the entire myeloma community, offering live, online, and print programs for patients, caregivers, and healthcare providers. You can always check our website, multiplemyeloma.org, to find the latest information on multiple myeloma and its treatments, as well as information on upcoming educational programs. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with key presenters from the myeloma educational session here at ASCO. I'd like to welcome Dr. Robert Orlowski from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas, Dr. Donna Reese from Princess Margaret Hospital in Toronto, Canada, and Dr. Jesus San Miguel from the University Hospital in Salamanca, Spain. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. Dr. Reese, in the education session, you discussed how responses to upfront treatment have vastly improved with newer agents like bortezomib and lenalidomide. Can you talk a little bit about how these agents have completely transformed the first-line treatment of myeloma, as well as how we consider the timing of stem cell transplantation?
I'll need to address both of those separately. I think numerous studies have shown that integration of novel agents, both before transplant and after transplant in the younger patients, and their integration along with conventional agents in the elderly population, have increased response rates, which in turn has increased progression-free survival, and in my opinion, increased overall survival, although from individual studies, that's often hard to discern. Meta-analyses are indicating this, however, and our own demographic results have shown progress in the life expectancy of individuals with this disease. There are a number of strategies and ways to do this. I think there's no one-size-fits-all for either younger or older patients. I've tended to look at it as the goals of a particular approach should be approximately in younger patients to achieve at least a 3-year progression-free survival with a transplant-related approach that should be increased further with post-transplant maintenance and or consolidation, so that the average PFS for a group of patients should be pushing 4 years or so. For the elderly, whereas melphalan and prednisone yielded about 12 to 18 months progression-free survival, either adding an agent to melphalan and prednisone are based on the data available using lenalidomide and dexamethasone, that should be increased to close to 2 years, also with evidence that overall survival is improving. So I think there's several ways to try to get to these goals, and oncologists should look at their own experience and define a group of regimens they're comfortable with and apply them to their patients. The question of timing of stem cell transplant is not resolved. Being in Canada, funding decisions are quite evidence-based, and that lends a certain critical eye to looking at results of timing of transplant. There is evidence from old studies, as well as evidence from some newer, relatively small single-center retrospective analyses that overall survival is likely comparable whether transplant is performed early or late. There's a lot of bias in these kinds of assessments, but what is missing is the progression-free survival of first-line therapy without transplant, and also what you can expect from a salvage transplant performed at relapse. Transplants do carry a definite period of morbidity and fatigue afterwards, and I suspect that even though the survival may be beneficial either route, to use a stem cell transplant at relapse and have, for instance, only 1 year progression-free survival does not seem like you're getting much bang for your buck when you're trying to develop an overall approach. So in my opinion, it's premature to abandon transplant as part of first-line treatment. We are anticipating trials that are randomized that should answer this question more definitively, and it may turn out that a delayed transplant is a very good option, particularly in some subtypes. But in my own opinion, I do believe it's premature to have a dramatic shift in our patient approaches.
Dr. Orlowski, has your approach to the timing of stem cell transplant changed with the use of bortezomib and lenalidomide up front?
Well, I think one question that's very commonly brought up by patients, which we haven't addressed, is whether they should even do a transplant at all. And sometimes patients feel that because of all the new drugs that we have recently gotten approved, that perhaps we can do away with transplant completely. And at least my message, and I don't know, Donna, what you think about that, my message is that we're still not at the point where we can do away with transplant because our chemotherapy-only approaches don't have the same kind of outcomes as they do probably with the addition of stem cell transplant. So I still do recommend transplant to my patients, and if anything, one could argue that transplant is underutilized because most studies suggest that only about a third of the transplant-eligible patients in the U.S. receive a transplant. And certainly some of them have good reasons not to, but I still think a third is a low number considering the benefits of transplant. Perhaps in the future, when we have more drug classes available, which may include monoclonal antibodies and maybe some kind of other immunotherapies, we can do a study looking at whether we can do away with transplant. But I don't think we're there yet, and so I've continued to recommend transplant for my patients.
And moving even earlier in the treatment continuum, Dr. Reese, can you discuss how the use of novel agents might change or is changing the way we think about treating smoldering myeloma, particularly in the high-risk setting?
That's a fascinating prospect, and I think the first step is being able to reliably identify a group of smoldering myeloma patients at high risk of transformation. And we heard from Dr. San Miguel's presentation that immunophenotyping can be very useful in this regard, and there are other risk stratification systems that have been able to identify those patients in whom the median time to progression to symptomatic myeloma is on the order of 2 years rather than much longer. There has been interesting information about lenalidomide and dexamethasone that has pushed the time to developing symptomatic disease in a significantly improved way, and this small trial also showed a survival advantage. There's a recent meta-analysis, I believe at this meeting, by the Ottawa group that suggested that treating high-risk smoldering disease did confer using several agents that have been reported in phase 3 trials does show an improvement in the time to progression. I think one will have to weigh the potential toxicity of these approaches, the potential cost, but we are at a point where we can start thinking about strategies to postpone the development, particularly of lytic bone disease, which is so devastating in this disease.
Now, some of the newest agents are being studied as part of a first-line treatment regimen, such as carfilzomib in combination with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, which has been studied in phase 1 and phase 2 trial by Dr. Jakubowiak and the MMRC. How might moving some of these really new agents into first-line therapy impact patients and how we select and sequence treatments?
Well, I think the future only looks brighter in that regard. If you have more potent regimens, the toxicity may allow longer and more prolonged treatment than we would anticipate a longer benefit, whether patients are older or younger. Of course, this approach is predicated on our ability to keep up with the refractory population with newer classes of drugs, which fortunately we're hearing promising preclinical information that such drugs are in the pipeline.
And then switching to a topic that has engendered quite a lot of discussion the past couple of years, the use of maintenance therapy, the timing, the duration, specific treatments to use, and then of course weighing the benefits and risks, particularly looking at the incidence of secondary primary malignancies. At this meeting, Dr. Palumbo presented a meta-analysis of data looking at SPMs. Can you talk a little bit about the thinking around the use of maintenance and the balance of risk and benefit?
This is a very controversial topic, and I don't pretend to have the right answer. But several thoughts. I think lenalidomide maintenance after transplant in particular has really extended the progression-free survival, and at least in one trial, as we know, overall survival. I think once one strays outside how the trial was performed, which was giving lenalidomide until disease progression, you can't count on the beneficial effect. So our current strategy at Princess Margaret, which is reevaluated annually or semi-annually depending on new data, has been to recommend it in all patients until disease progression. The pivotal trials do have subset analyses which suggest there may be benefit that is largely due to certain subsets. In the CALGB trial, those are patients who had lenalidomide at diagnosis. The effect is more pronounced for those not in complete remission. But again, wearing my Canadian hat, those subgroup analyses are, quote, hypothesis generating, end quote. They're not the final word on this. My own bias is that when we have better tools to look and see what we're doing to the myeloma population in the marrow, such as MRD and other techniques, we can hopefully move beyond a blunt instrument approach and exposing all patients to the drug as long as possible. The risk of secondary primary malignancies is also a challenging one, but secondary malignancies occur with a lot of our cancer drugs. It's not unique to lenalidomide, although there is a consistent signal, and I think efforts to determine risk factors such as the proximity of alkylating agents, age, may help us minimize that risk, just as what happened with Hodgkin's disease and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma when survival was extended and we started learning about secondary cancers and those hematologic diseases.
Dr. Olesky, what are your thoughts on the data around the use of maintenance therapy and your approach at MD Anderson?
I think I agree with what you heard from Donna in terms of recommending lenalidomide maintenance as a standard after transplant for now. One question that I think we're going to still have to answer is, as we're improving our upfront therapies and getting more patients into a state where they're minimal residual disease negative, will maintenance therapy still be of benefit in that setting? And maybe what we'll be doing in the future is some kind of MRD-adapted approach where we'll treat those people who still have residual disease with maintenance until they achieve some level of MRD, and then perhaps stop until there is evidence that the MRD negative test has turned positive. And that could be one way to reduce exposure to some of these drugs and therefore hopefully reduce the risk of second primary malignancies and of course reduce the cost of maintenance. But for right now, I still think lenalidomide is the standard of care. And in fact, we're building on that by doing a study in a pilot basis of lenalidomide with ixazomib, combining IMIDs and proteasome inhibitors for maintenance therapy in an all-oral approach.
Dr. Orlowski, you covered treatment options for patients who are relapsed and refractory to lenalidomide and bortezomib during the education session. Let's talk a little bit about some of these newer treatments. There are quite a few abstracts on pomalidomide plus low-dose dex at this meeting, the phase 3 MM03, as well as some other trials. Can you tell us a little bit about these data on pomalidomide?
The double refractory patient population is an important one to try to develop new therapies for, because with increasing use of lenalidomide and bortezomib as part of induction and then after transplant as part of consolidation and even maintenance, we need new treatment options for these folks. Pomalidomide, as you mentioned, is one of the drugs that looks like it has very good activity for those patients. It was approved in February of 2013, and there have been a number of single-arm and also randomized studies which do show that pomalidomide with low-dose dexamethasone has about a 30% response rate in patients with double refractory myeloma. And the median overall survival in that setting is a little over 1 year, which is not as long as we would like for it to be, but better than the benchmark, which is about 9 months. And in the future, I think more and more combinations are being looked at with pomalidomide that hopefully will improve the activity even further.
And then there are the new proteasome inhibitors, the recently approved last July carfilzomib and the oral agent exazomib, which is in phase 3. Tell us a little bit about these agents and how they fit into the treatment of patients.
Yeah, that's a great question. We have a couple of, as you mentioned, proteasome inhibitors now other than bortezomib. Carfilzomib is another drug that has activity in the double refractory patient population as well as in patients with just relapsed disease or disease that is refractory only to one of those two drugs. In the double refractory population, the response rate is about 15 to 17%, with overall the response rate to carfilzomib being about 25%. And I mentioned earlier combinations may be the way to go, and a couple of combinations that look interesting include bortezomib with pomalidomide and also carfilzomib with pomalidomide. You mentioned exazomib, which is an oral proteasome inhibitor, and certainly that drug looks exciting from a convenience perspective and also from a side effect profile because, like carfilzomib, which has a lower rate of neuropathy than bortezomib, exazomib also seems to have a low rate of neuropathy. Right now, the study that's being done, which hopefully will lead to its approval, is for patients with relapsed disease after 1 to 3 prior therapies, and it's going to be with exazomib, lenalidomide, and dex versus lenalidomide and dexamethasone as the comparator. So exazomib is a great drug, does not seem to have that much activity in the double refractory population.
And then two agents that you specifically mentioned during the education session, daratumumab and ARRAY-520. Tell us a little bit about those.
Well, in addition to new drugs in old classes, we also need new drugs in new classes with new mechanisms of action. And two that look interesting, one is a drug called ARRAY-520, doesn't have a name yet, and it actually works by blocking cell division of myeloma cells and is particularly effective against cancers that depend on a protein called MCL1 for survival, and myeloma seems to be exactly that type of cancer. The early data with ARRAY-520, either alone or with the addition of dexamethasone, suggests a 20 to 30% response rate. And the 30% applies to the combination with dex in patients with disease that was refractory to bortezomib and lenalidomide and dexamethasone. So that's a very difficult to treat patient population. And certainly we're hoping that that will be an exciting drug. And the other drug which you mentioned is daratumumab, and that's a monoclonal antibody. We have a number of antibodies that are being tested, probably the one that is furthest along is elotuzumab. And there's been a study that's been completed for patients with relapsed myeloma with elotuzumab, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, but the data have not yet been presented, but we all hope that that will be positive and lead to its approval. Elotuzumab seems to be better for patients with relapsed myeloma, not so much for patients with refractory myeloma. Daratumumab, which is a different antibody and attaches to CD38, which is a protein on the surface of most myeloma cells, has shown nice activity by itself in patients with relapsed and refractory disease. And one of the advantages of antibodies is that because they're large molecules, they're too large to get inside most cells in the body, so generally the side effect profile is fairly favorable. The same is true so far for daratumumab, and there's going to be a large phase 2 international and especially national study in the U.S. which will look at patients with, again, this kind of double refractory myeloma to see if daratumumab by itself would be effective. And if that trial were positive, it would lead to the approval of the drug.
Dr. Reese, what are some of the classes or agents that you're monitoring for promise in the clinic?
Well, I think to reiterate what Dr. Orlowski said, pomalidomide has been a nice step forward. And on a practical basis, I think it's very easy to use because its administration and toxicity profile are very similar to lenalidomide, so there's a comfort in switching classes. The second generation proteasome inhibitors do appear to be more potent than bortezomib and offer a good chance for combination. As Dr. Orlowski said as well, developing entire new classes of drugs is important, and there are a number that are under investigation that may block specific steps and signaling pathways that are important in myeloma cells and in stromal cells. There are insulin growth factor receptors that are under evaluation, nuclear transport inhibitors that are opening up further avenues for evaluation as single agents in double refractory disease or combinations with steroids or some of the older conventional therapeutic agents or the novel agents in their first generation or two.
Yeah, I think those are all great points. The other area I think which is developing nicely is immunotherapy. And there's a number of, in addition to monoclonal antibodies, which to some extent are immunotherapies, but there's a number of approaches that are being tried at various centers, including vaccine approaches, both in patients with earlier stages of myeloma to try to prevent perhaps progression to symptomatic disease. And at MD Anderson, we're doing a study of vaccination around the time of transplant to try to help get rid of more myeloma than is the case with just transplant alone. And another area where there's a lot of excitement is in the chimeric antigen receptor realm, where what you try to do is take the patient's own T cells and direct them against proteins on the surface of myeloma cells to make the patient's own immune system work for the patient. And other ways of perhaps stimulating the immune system with antibodies that target parts of the myeloma cell that suppress the immune system. And these are with antibodies against, for example, PD-1 or PD-1 ligand.
I think one other intriguing aspect of myeloma is something that we've been witnessing in the clinic, is that advanced disease may not seem much like myeloma with lytic lesions and anemia, but may be a very widespread disease that can affect liver, CNS, lymph nodes, has a very high proliferative rate. And I wondered that until we can cure the disease, one overall strategy might be a way to prevent this almost blast phase of a chronic disease, although I don't have any specific recommendations in this regard.
Dr. San Miguel, you covered standard as well as new tools for diagnosing and monitoring multiple myeloma in the education session this afternoon. Can you summarize some of the standard tests that you so eloquently outlined in the session?
Okay, thank you very much for this question. I think standard techniques remain the gold standard for management of multiple myeloma. And I started by emphasizing the clinical history, because sometimes we forget that this may be critical, particularly for comorbidities, because they may drive the type of treatment that you choose if a patient has comorbidities. Also amyloid symptoms and also pain. If the patient complains about pain and the conventional X-ray don't show a lytic lesion in a particular area, then you may do more sophisticated imaging techniques. Then, as you can see, the first step is a good clinical history. I have also emphasized the routine protein analysis and the 24 hours urine particularly, because some physicians forget this and substitute the 24 hours conventional Benjones by the serum-free light chain. That is not an alternative. Serum-free light chain is a marvelous technique for oligosecretory and non-secretory myeloma, and also for Benjones escape, and also a predictor marker for progression in a smoldering or MGAS, but not a substitution of Benjones protein. And also I emphasize as part of the routine that the FIS analysis should be performed in all patients, but on separated, isolated CD138 plasma cells. I also mentioned when to repeat and not to repeat tests. For instance, the skeletal analysis should not be repeated unless there is localized pain that alerts you about a potential lytic lesion. When to repeat the bone marrow? If there is no cytopenia or not an alert about the potential NDS because low white blood cell count, probably you don't need to repeat the bone marrow. And these are tests that are repeated very frequently without not need. And the same apply for cytogenetics. If the patient has already high-risk cytogenetic diagnosis, you don't need to repeat it.
Can you also talk a little bit more about some of the newer imaging techniques, such as MRI, CT scan, PET, and when they may be appropriate?
Yeah. I think MRI is a beautiful technique, particularly if you have a patient with a solitary plasmacytoma or a smoldering myeloma, because they can detect occult lesions that speak in favor or disseminated disease. If we talk about a smoldering myeloma, we know that the presence of focal lesion on MRI is associated with a shortened time to progression, approximately 15 months median time to progression. Also, MRI and CT are very important techniques for detection of occult lesions that has not been shown, as I mentioned before, and has not been shown in the conventional X-ray. There is other areas in which MRI can be of value, and is this in a vertebral collapse, just to distinguish between osteoporosis and myeloma infiltration. And as you can see, there are several areas in which MRI or CT scan are mandatory or highly recommended to be used, as was proposed in the recent guidelines published in 2011 in Blood. Regarding PET scan is not a standard technique. And the reason is because it's associated with false negative result and false positive result. You may have a false positive result due to inflammation, and you may have a false negative result due to the use of high-dose corticosteroids. But being said this, I think PET is going to become more and more used in the clinic for detection of extramedullary disease, very important. Also, to detect patients that may have aggressive disease if they have high LDH, early relapses, particularly extramedullary sites. In that context of Benjamin's escape, I think the use of PET is going to be highly valuable. But I close my presentation by showing a case in which I think represent the good balance between the new techniques and the old techniques. And that particular case was a patient that was showing apparently a progression during the mobilization because the gamma globulin increased and the IgG increased during mobilization. But the conventional electrophoresis showed that this was not a progression because the increase was a polyclonal reconstitution. and in fact was associated with the presence of an infection in that particular patient, then this is my final message. We cannot remain the management of myeloma with the old technique. We need a new techniques, but don't forget to look to the electrophoresis because it still remains the standard marker, biomarker for multiple myeloma. And the other message that I think is important, some people may claim that the new techniques are expensive, for instance, MRD, but they are more cheaper than what is one single cycle of new drugs with a single additional cycle that may not be needed of new drugs, you may pay probably for all the new techniques that could help you to adapt the duration of consolidation of maintenance. Then I think this is important.
So you mentioned MRD, minimal residual disease, and this is really an area in which you're pioneering. Tell us a little bit more about the measurement and the importance of MRD, both in looking at prognosis and predicting response to therapy.
Okay. The first idea that I want to share with you about MRD, MRD can be measured by flow, by ASO-PCR, and by next-generation sequencing, and I have shown the data on the three alternatives. Both of them are very parallel. We have done the analysis in over 100 patients with the three techniques and are almost parallel. But the first important message is that to have MRD positive is bad because this show the presence of residual disease. An MRD negative, by contrast, is not so informative because an MRD negative could be the result of a real negative situation or just because the bone marrow sample is not representative enough of the cellularity. As you know, the infiltration in multiple myeloma is patchy, and it could be that it is not representative enough, the sample that we have used. Being said this, I think it's good if we analyze now another potential pitfall of MRD studies, and is the lack of reproducibility that has been claimed, or the need for high expertise that has been claimed by several groups. Now, I think both the Spanish and the UK group has shown that in both countries, exactly the same result, different series, and the value of being MRD negative is clear for transplant patient and non-transplant patient. And I think we are now facing a situation similar to other hematological malignancies. The best the quality of the response, the longer the survival. And if you use in CML, in ALL, AML, ALL, and non-Hodgkin lymphoma, more sensitive techniques, why myeloma patients don't deserve the same tools?
So one final question, and I know, you know, you're coming from Spain, but do you see there being widespread adoption of measuring MRD in the U.S.?
We are working on this. I mean, as you know, the European consortium, the Euroflow consortium, is working on standardization, and we are working on the development of platforms for automatized MRD, and hopefully this is going to be a spread. I mean, several investigators from the American groups have been paying a visit to our institution just for the standardization, and I hope this is going to be used more and more.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, and thanks very much for holding this, because I think information is one of the most important tools for patients as well as caregivers.
Thank you for joining us today. I'd especially like to thank our speakers, Dr. Orlowski, Reese, and San Miguel, for providing such an insightful overview of the treatment options for multiple myeloma covered during ASCO this year. Visit our website, multiplemyeloma.org, to find the latest information on multiple myeloma and its treatments. We're also pleased to announce the launch of a new webcast on our website, highlights from the 14th International Myeloma Workshop that was held this past April. Also, your feedback and comments are very important to us as we plan for future webcasts and other types of programming. It helps us to prepare both the format of our programs as well as future topics. So I strongly encourage all of you to take a few minutes to complete the evaluation form at the end of this webcast. Thank you for participating and have a wonderful day.